Thank you to all the organisers for the invitation to Waterloo and Perimeter. So today I would like to give sort of a survey of some parts of recent work with the following collaborators: so Alessio Corti, Johannes Nordström, and Tommaso Pacini, who is in the audience here. The main actors in this, some of these have appeared in some talks already in the conference, in talks of Robert Bryant, and to some extent, Ronan Conlon yesterday for Calabi-Yau geometry. But I'm going to sort of reprise some of those things, because while there are some experts in the audience, there are also some people that will not know this at all. So hopefully these have something for both. When I mean G2 geometry, in this case, what I mean is Riemannian manifolds with holonomy, the compact group G2. So in Berger's classification in the mid-50s, then the only sort of odd dimensional non-generic holonomy that occurred was the group G2. And there's been a long story since then of looking for manifolds with holonomy G2. And Robert Bryant played a fundamental role in the first several steps of that. So it's great to be able to talk in front of Robert. So, but what I want to talk about is compact manifolds with G2 holonomy. And these are examples of manifolds with natural calibrations, one of which, the co-associative calibration, played the starring role in Robert's talk, but there's another one, associative calibration, and so these lead to special kinds of submanifolds. And so what I want to do is to talk about how to find many new compact G2 manifolds and some of these special submanifolds. So our initial goal when we started this, what seems like many years ago, was to look for, to try and build compact G2 manifolds in which we could find compact associative threefold, and then rigid, I'll explain better what that means later on. But in the process of doing so, then there were sort of a number of byproducts, which I will try and explain also. So it leads to the construction of lots of new non-compact Calabi-Yau threefolds. So Ronan's talk yesterday was emphasizing Calabi-Yau threefolds that were non-compact, that at infinity looked like a cone. In this case, what's required is a different asymptotic geometry at infinity, things that become more like asymptotically a cylinder. So out of these, we're going to be able to construct many new compact G2 manifolds in a way that I will explain. And then, well, we realized that the G2 manifolds that we construct this way, many of them are in some sense a bit simpler to understand topologically than some of the previous examples, particularly the ones due to Joyce. And so it's actually possible now that we can understand, in many cases, the diffeomorphism type of the underlying seven manifold. So as far as we know, this is the first case where this has been done. And since we can do this in a relatively robust way, then we can say, well, there are different ways to construct G2 metrics on the same seven manifold. And you know, we can find things with associative submanifolds. And when we can build G2 metrics on the same seven manifold that have at least the obvious number of associative threefolds that you find as differs. So then finally, then I'll talk just briefly about some sort of way that you can basically, by changing the Calabi-Yaus in some controlled way, you can change between G2 metrics in the same way, in some similar way. So there are sort of related G2 metrics on different seven manifolds. So my aim is to try and at least sketch these sort of developments. So here's a sort of mnemonic slide to puzzle and hopefully motivate something. So I'll just try and understand what these mean. So there's going to, I mean, we're going to build up things in G2 by actually understanding simpler things inside of them. So the role of various compact subgroups of G2 is going to play an important role. So as are some deep arithmetical facts. So I'm going to start by trying to explain just the importance of SU2 inside of SU3 inside of G2. It will take a little bit more time to explain what I mean by this line here. And so this is at the level of the G2 manifolds. At the level of submanifolds, then again, we're going to find associative things by reducing to other better understood things, namely holomorphic curves. So it'll take me some time to explain what this slide is about. So Robert gave a characterization of the group G2 in terms of the Octonian. So let me repeat some of this here, and he also mentioned the starring role of this fundamental three form. So I can think of, if I think of the Octonians, I can look at the automorphism group. That's one way of saying group G2. Another way is to pick a sufficiently generic three form in R7 and then just look at its stabilizer. So one way to go between the first and the second is to think of the cross product on the imaginary Octonians. So just do what you would have done for the imaginary quaternions to get the cross product there. And so just take the imaginary part of the Octonionic product of two imaginary Octonians. So out of the cross product then and the inner product, then I can build the associated three form just by taking the cross product of two of them and dotting it with a third. So that turns out to give me a three form, and then this particular three form, for example, the stabilizer of that you can think of as the group G2. Okay. But what's going to be more important for this talk are some sort of ways to see this in terms of splitting off various factors off the R7. So this is the SU2 inside, and SU2 inside of SU3 inside of G2. So I start on C3 with the standard SU3 structure. So I take a Kähler form and a holomorphic 3-0 form, capital omega. And then I want to look at R7 split as R cross C3 and rewrite the G2 form in this term. So if I have coordinate T on R, then it turns out that I can rewrite my three form as DT wedge the two form plus the real part of the three form. In particular, then, if I look at things that leave invariant this R, then, well, obviously SU3, the thing that SU3 will preserve both of these, and in fact, that's exactly the stabilizer. So there's an so we have this SU3 sitting inside of G2 as a stabilizer of this R direction. And more generally, if I take a Calabi-Yau threefold, by which I mean a Riemannian manifold with holonomy inside of, or equal to SU3, or and I take just the metric product with a flat S1, then that will have holonomy SU3 sitting inside of G2. So thanks to Yau's proof of the Calabi conjecture, then of course we know many compact holonomy SU3 manifolds. So the question is really, you want to find compact manifolds not with holonomy contained in G2, but with the full group G2. But but it's going to turn out to be fruitful to look at non-compact manifolds with holonomy SU3 and then put them together in some way so that the holonomy gets forced to go up to the full G2. So we could further split off R inside of an R3 and remaining C2, and then express things in terms of coordinates on this R3 factor and the standard SU2 structure on C2, which now I write as Kähler form and holomorphic volume form, but which I split as omega j plus I omega k, thinking more quaternionically. So when I do this, then now I have a factor on the R3, and then I have the coordinates on R3, which each pair with one of these three. So if I fix the whole of R3, so I fix all of these, then the subgroup of G2 that fixes this R3 is a copy of SU2. So these sorts of formulae will come back later on when I try to explain how to get a G2 manifold out of two sort of simpler pieces. So the upshot is there are these close relations between G2 holonomy and Calabi-Yau geometries in lower dimensions, and those are going to be fundamental to the way that we build up our G2 holonomy manifolds. Okay, so I need to say a few words about we in order to build a G2 manifold, we need some kind of strategy to do this. So we need to build something a little bit weaker and then push it around a bit to get it to be what we want. So we want to allow ourselves to look at so-called G2 structures. So Robert called them definite, or sometimes they're called positive three forms. So just the three forms. So if I just look at the three forms on R7 that are equivalent to say the particular model that I already wrote down. So what we want, so a G2 structure on a 7 manifold is just a three form that looks like this three form at every point. So I have a 7 manifold, oriented 7 manifold, and at every point, then I have some isomorphism between the tangent space and R7 that pulls back my particular one that I chose to the standard one. Oh, sorry, the other way around. Pulls back the standard one to the one that I chose. So the positive three forms are an open subset in the set of all three forms. So you can just compute dimensions in both ways. So all I mean by a G2 structure is a choice of a particular positive three form. And the openness is important because it just says if I make a sufficiently small perturbation of my G2 structure, then I get another G2 structure. So because the group G2 sits inside of SO7, then it, giving me a G2 structure also gives me a metric. And then I would like to know when is that metric actually has holonomy inside of the group G2. So the following lemma is sort of the basic point here. So I pick a G2 structure, so that induces a metric G, and then the holonomy of that is contained in G2, is equivalent to either of the two following conditions. One, that the three form becomes parallel with respect to Levi-Civita of that metric, or more usefully, this third condition, which says that this form should be closed and co-closed. So notice in order to find co-closed, then I need to know Hodge-Starr, so I need to know something about the metric. So and the metric depends non-linearly on the three form. So the second condition here is a non-linear condition in the original three form. So we call such a G2 structure a torsion-free G2 structure because of this condition, but I mean, it can be said there's an intrinsic torsion of the G2 structure, and this is saying its intrinsic torsion is vanishing. So this tells us a condition that the holonomy reduces to a subgroup of G2, but I want to know, we've said it's easy to find things with, relatively easy to find things with holonomy SU3, so I want a condition that says I don't get SU3, I get the full group G2. So then we have the following sort of conditions. So first of all, well, I need to know what sorts of seven manifolds admit G2 structures in the first place. So that's relatively straightforward. It's completely algebra topological. So it turns out that all you need to be is orientable and spinnable. Then suppose that you have a compact G2 manifold that has a torsion-free G2 structure. Then the holonomy will be the full group G2 if and only if it has finite fundamental group. So this comes as a sort of consequence of looking at if the holonomy reduced, what sorts of thing could it reduce to, and using Bourget classification and Durham, etc. So a necessary condition for looking for a compact holonomy G2 manifold is to have an orientable spin manifold with finite fundamental group. There are further conditions. So another condition, for example, that holds in this full holonomy case is that actually the first Pontryagin class must be non-zero. So for example, it's no good thinking about parallelizable manifolds or stably parallelizable manifolds. We need something somewhat more complicated. So this fact here is a consequence of sort of some G2 representation theory together with Chern-Weil theory. So, at the moment we have very little idea about what the full topological consequences are for admitting a G2 holonomy metric. But these are the most obvious things. There is one further condition on the cohomology ring that also follows in the same spirit as this last one. So I've said enough now to be able to at least say what is some possible strategy to construct G2 holonomy metrics. So the strategy would be, well, so first of all, I want to try and find a G2 structure where its failure to be torsion free is sufficiently small. So I can measure that. For example, we said that the three form had to be closed and co-closed. So something where D of phi and D star of phi are sufficiently small, that would be one version of this. And then on a compact manifold with finite fundamental group. So if I can then find a perturbation of this to make it torsion free, then from B, we will get a holonomy G2 manifold. So the question is, how are we going to find G2 structures that have small torsion, and then how do we know that we can perturb ones that have small torsion to no torsion? So I should just say, essentially, at the moment there are two main constructions of G2 holonomy metrics. The first one compact G2 holonomy matrix. The first one due to Dominic Joyce, and the second one due to Alexei Kovalev, based on ideas by Simon Donaldson. And in both cases, then we're looking at sort of G2 metrics close to some kind of boundary of the moduli space of all of those. But as part of Dominic's orbifold construction, then basically Dominic already understood what to do in terms of the analysis here. So he proved a very general theorem that says, at least if you have a G2 structure that's closed and sufficiently close to torsion-free, then he understood how to correct it to G2 holonomy. So in some sense, the answer to 2, given 1, was already understood by Joyce. And so the question is, how do you actually find things that have, how do you find examples of G2 structures with sufficiently small torsion on manifolds with finite fund group? So far I've been concentrating on the G2 manifolds, and now I want to say a few things about the interesting submanifolds. So we will return soon to actually find how to get some of these G2 structures. So Robert in his talk was talking about calibration and in particular the co-associative calibration in R7, but let me just remind people what I mean by a calibration. So this was a notion pioneered by Rhys Harvey and Blaine Lawson, sort of modeled on Kähler geometry to some extent. So I have, it's a distinguished class of minimal submanifolds in some Riemannian manifold, which arise because of the presence of a special kind of differential form. So I have my Riemannian manifold, and on it I have some closed p-form, smooth closed p-form. And then I want it to satisfy a certain condition with respect to the metric, namely that this inequality holds. So a way of saying this is that for any tangent plane, I take some orthonormal frame for it, E1 through EP, oriented orthonormal frame. I stick those into the form, and I should get the number at most 1. So this is the so-called co-mass 1 condition. And as soon as I have this inequality, then I could look at the planes where equality holds, and so if there are any, and those are a distinguished set of planes that we call the calibrated planes. So it gives you a subset of the oriented p-planes at every point. So this is just a pointwise statement. And then a submanifold being calibrated just says it's an oriented submanifold whose oriented tangent space lives in this set at every point. So the fundamental reason to be interested in this is the following simple lemma, that say if I took something compact without boundary, for example, in the simplest case, then it minimizes volume in its homology class. So for anyone who has not seen this before, then I leave this as a proof. You can write it down in one line, and it uses Stokes theorem once and the definition a couple of times. So calibrated submanifolds, as Robert was explaining, were important because you could actually use them to prove that things were volume minimizing. So as soon as we think of G2 geometry, well, we think of this standard 3 form and its Hodge-Dahl. So we've got these are both G2 invariant, these turn out to be G2 invariant calibrations on R7, and the 4 form calibration is exactly the geometry that Robert considered in his talk. So in this talk, we're more interested in the three-form calibration. So these are associative planes. These are called associative planes. So the three planes calibrated by this three-form we call associative planes, because they correspond to associative subalgebras of the imaginary Actonians. And so in my splitting that I wrote down of R inside of R3 cross C2, then that R3 was an associative three-plane. And since it turns out that G2 acts transitively on associative three-planes, so sort of anything is equivalent to this particular R3. So for this talk, we are less interested in the co-associatives. And what's more interesting now is that, well, so this was just the picture on R7. But now, thanks to this holonomy parallel tensor correspondence, so if I have any manifold whose holonomy is contained in G2, then these three forms and four forms on R7, there are parallel three and four forms modeled on these things on my G2 manifold. So in particular, it means that we can talk about associative and co-associative calibrations on any manifold with holonomy inside of G2. And so then the question is, okay, so I go to a lot of work to find compact holonomy G2 manifolds. Can I go through some more work to find interesting submanifolds? And that was our initial aim, was to find compact G2 manifolds in which I could find associative submanifolds sitting around somewhere. So I will explain a bit later why it's actually trickier to find associative things than co-associative things, basically because they have worse deformation theory. So now, how are we going to find? So how are we going to try and find associatives? Well, so we again want to look at another, so splitting again. So we return to this splitting of R3 as we had before. So we said that if I took a Calabi-Yau and took its product with a flat S1, then I got holonomy SU3 inside of G2. So let's think of the geometry of associatives in this particular case. So what's important is, so in my holonomy SU3 manifold, my Calabi-Yau, then this also has various calibrations. So it has just the complex calibration. So if I just take the Kähler form, that turns out to be a calibration, and the calibrated submanifolds are just complex curves. It also has a special Lagrangian calibration, which is less important for today's talk. So the important thing are the complex curves. So in particular, if I take a complex curve C inside of X, if I take C inside of X and I take its product with S1 inside of this sort of degenerate G2 holonomy manifold, then this is associative. I take a curve, a surface, and it's associative if and only if that's a holomorphic curve. And moreover, when we look at the infinitesimal deformations of this as an associative threefold, then the only such things are the infinitesimal deformations of that as a holomorphic curve. So the importance of this later on is going to be, it's very difficult in general to control infinitesimal deformations of a random associative. But if the associative looks like a product of S1 with a holomorphic curve, then, well, understanding infinitesimal deformations of holomorphic curves is understanding the number of holomorphic sections of the normal bundle, and that's something that I have a lot of technology to help with. So it's going to be crucial that we're going to sort of reduce to being able to do something on something like S1 cross an appropriate holomorphic curve and then perturb away from it. So just as a parenthetical remark, then if I did the same thing with a special Lagrangian threefold in my Calabi-Yau, take the product, then I get a co-associative. But this is less important for today's talk. So this is where I try and explain this puzzling mnemonic at the top. So this is at the essence of the method is how is it going to help me that I understand things with SU3 holonomy very well and G2 holonomy much worse. So Simon Donaldson had suggested the following idea to construct compact G2 manifolds. So the idea is you want to look at a compact G2 manifold which is developing a very long neck. So you want to look at something where the diameter is you know, one way in which a family of, I should have said, any holonomy G2 manifold is Ricci flat. So this is one of the motivations for looking at them. So then when you just think about ways that compact Ricci flat manifolds could degenerate, then one way they can degenerate is just by their diameter becoming large. So what we would expect in this case is that we see some sort of almost cylindrical neck developing. And so Simon was essentially suggesting looking at things where the diameter is sufficiently large. But in general, you would just expect to see some asymptotically cylindrical G2 manifold develop. But it's not clear that understanding those is any simpler than understanding the compact ones. So what Simon's insight was that you could instead do something that sort of reduced the problem one dimension. So while we don't really understand in any generality asymptotically cylindrical G2 manifolds, then asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yau threefolds, we can construct quite a lot of them. So we're going to prove some kind of non-compact version of the Calabi conjecture to construct asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yau threefolds. Then what are we going to do with those? So we do this product construction to give me a Riemannian manifold now with holonomy SU3, and then it has an end that looks like, well, in this case, it's going to be, so the end of the X3 is going to be topologically just R plus cross S1 cross K3, and now we've got an extra S1 factor from the product, so our end is topologically a sort of cylinder over this cross-section, T2 cross K3. So now we want to take a pair of those and put them together in some way. But we want to put them, the most obvious way of putting those two together, if I just took, so I've got some kind of, I've got a pair of, so these are supposed to be a pair of asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yau threefolds. So then I take S1 across each of these. So I could try to just do some kind of connect sum, but if I just did the connect sum in the most obvious way, then this S1 factor would come along through the ride and I would have infinite fundamental group. And so I would just end up getting probably a Calabi-Yau threefold cross S1. So we don't want to do that. We want to do something that's going to kill the fundamental, or as much of the fundamental, make the fundamental group finite. So we're going to use the fact that the cross section is actually this special split form. And so we're going to twist the connect sum. So I will explain on the next slide more precisely what I mean by this. So the idea is that we don't just do a connect sum, we do a connect sum together with some extra twist. And out of this, we will be able to build a G2 structure with small torsion on a manifold with finite fundamental group. And so then now you apply the analysis of Joyce and prove it can be corrected to torsion free. So this was first implemented by Alexei Kovalev in 2003, where the non-compact Calabi-Yau threefolds that you start with were obtained from these Fano threefolds. So let me just explain this twisting a bit more carefully. So for this, we need to go back to one of the other ways that that we wrote down the three form in terms of this splitting off of R3. So the G2 structure on my MIs, so that's the S1 cross the Calabi-Yaus. So this is asymptotic to, well, so I think of coordinates, so. So this is my M1, my M2. And so it has an end that was R plus cross T2 cross K3. And then with this has coordinates T, theta 1, theta 2. And then probably what? So if you go back, so if you just reinterpret what I said earlier about the splitting of R3 off, then we can write the G2 structure on this becomes asymptotic to this product G2 structure. So it sees the two theta factors, the T, and then it pairs each of the theta factors with one of the, so we've got a, on the K3 surface, it's a hyperkähler K3, so we have omega I, omega j, omega k, and then this pairs the theta 1 with omega I, theta 2 with omega j, and dt with omega k. So what we want to understand is, if I just look at the structures on the end, then I want to make some identification of the ends, and I want to get a well-defined G2 structure. So in order to get a well-defined G2 structure, then, and I want to get a manifold with finite fundamental group. So Simon's idea was, well, rather than just doing a connect sum, which would just sort of have T to something like this, then at the same time, I've got a torus factor, so I should exchange those two factors. So I should switch theta 2 and theta 1, okay? But I can't just do that by itself because I want to get a well-defined G2 structure. So I'm going to have to do something on the final K3 also. And so if we think about, so I'm essentially sending T to minus T, and I'm flipping the order of theta 1 and theta 2. So back here, if I change the sign of this and change that, this is okay. But now what I want to do is I want to say change theta 1 to theta 2. So that means I have to exchange the roles of I and J. And then I'm changing the sign of this, so I have to send K to minus K. So what this means is, what I want to do is I want to find a map of K3s that pulls back omega I on the second one to omega J on the first one, vice versa, and then omega K to minus omega K. So this is sometimes called matching data or hyperkähler rotation. And this finding such a map of K3s is a non-trivial and relatively subtle part of the construction. But the moment that you can do this, then you can build your G2 structure. The G2 structure will be, you can make it closed, you can make its torsion very small, and then Joyce's previous analysis says, therefore, you can make it torsion-free. So, So in Kovalev's construction, then he found his building blocks in the first place from Fano Three Falls, building on work of Tian Yao. And so, as I said, it's a non-trivial thing to actually construct these hyperkähler rotations. So it's not enough just to construct these asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yaus. You have to construct them with good enough control that you can actually find hyperkähler rotation. So the full details of doing this are technical, but let me give a sort of cartoon sketch. I mean, the main tool that you have for constructing diffeomorphisms of K3s is to use the global Torelli theorems. And so then it will turn out that if you use global Torelli theorems together with results about embedding certain kinds of lattices inside of the K3 lattice, then you can use this sort of technology to find hyperkähler rotations for suitable initial pairs. So I should say that, this is more subtle than it looks, and the original argument in Kovalev was not quite correct. So some of the statements that he makes there are not literally true. Nonetheless, there is something, there's an appropriate modification of it that does work. But it provided you can solve this matching problem, then you can proceed. So given a pair of Calabi-Yaus, asymptotic cylindrical Calabi-Yaus, and a hyperkähler rotation between them, then you can always glue to get compact G2 manifolds. So if you're given 1 and 2, then this part 3, the analysis part, always works. So the message at the moment is that there's a complicated PDE for G2 metrics, this closed and co-closed three form, but we have now reduced it to two problems about complex projective three form. And I need to say, now I need to say something about what do you do? So we've reduced this highly nonlinear PDE to problems in complex geometry, which superficially sounds a bit absurd. Okay. So the hard work now is not in the analysis, it's in the algebraic geometry. So underlying the construction of asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yaus was this work of Tian Yao from 1990s. So Ronan already mentioned other work of theirs out of a similar vintage, but that was for constructing asymptotically conical things. We want to construct things that are asymptotically cylindrical. You don't need to follow all of the details, but in a similar way to Ronan's talk yesterday, then the idea will be if you find the right kind of quasi-projective manifold, then you'll be able to construct Ricci-flat asymptotically cylindrical metrics on that. So in this case, the special thing that we need is that we're really going to need X to fiber over an algebraic curve, and actually in our case the curve has got to be just P1. So I should think of projective manifold that fibers over P1, and then what I want is I'm going to take a divisor inside of X that basically is just, I just take a bunch of smooth reduced fibers and I look at and that's my divisor. So then I take away the divisor and look at this non-compact manifold, this non-compact quasi-projective thing. And so there's a version of the Calabi conjecture in this case. So the appropriate thing that I should be looking at is this sense of product. So I look at a class in C1 of this, and I look at a 1-1 form inside of here, and it says that any 1-1 form in here representing this class, then I can find a Kähler metric that has that class as its Ricci form. And moreover, this thing has linear volume growth. So certainly, if I want to construct something that's supposed to be asymptotically cylindrical, it should have linear volume growth. So if we want to construct Ricci flat metrics, then I want this class here to be zero. So I should take D to be an anti-canonical divisor. So the upshot is, in order to get complete Calabi-Yau metrics with linear volume growth, then what I need is a projective manifold that fibers over P1, and so that the generic fiber is a smooth anti-canonical divisor. So that's you know, if I can do that, then I can go ahead and do the analysis. So the original paper of Tian and Yao did not prove that these things are asymptotically cylindrical in a kind of strong sense, and so it's necessary to improve these asymptotics. Kovalev gave an argument for that. There are some problems with the way he wrote that, but you can still do this. And in fact, you know, you can give a very short self-contained proof in the asymptotically cylindrical case that doesn't rely on the Tian Yao, which works under more general assumptions. And so let me stop that. So now we're gradually reducing to more and more sort of concrete algebra geometric problems. So it's going to suffice to find then, so we want to find a smooth projective threefold that contains a pair of anti-canonical divisors that are smooth K3 surfaces and that intersect transversally. So if they intersect transversally, then I'm going to get some smooth curve. So I think of the pencil generated by it. So this gives me some anti-canonical pencil. This is the base locus of this pencil. And then I'm just going to blow up my original threefold along the base locus of this curve to get a new projective threefold. And now I just look at the proper transforms of those two divisors, and they will now be smooth anti-canonical divisors on the blown up manifold. And now the pencil that they determine will actually give you a morphism to P1. So they will really fiber over P1 now. And the generic fiber is a smooth anti-canonical K3. And so then I just choose any of these smooth fibers, and I remove one of those. And so then Tian Yao plus, you know, so this analysis tells you, in such a case, this thing will admit an asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yau metric. So we need to find ourselves a good supply of such threefolds. So this is where Fano and weak, and this notion weak Fano come in. So in Kovalev's construction, he showed how to do this from a Fano manifold. So a Fano manifold is something like projective space or a sufficiently low degree hypersurface in projective space. So it's something where the anti-canonical bundle is positive. So these are things where the first Chern class is positive. So a weak Fano is something where, well, I just have to interpret, I have to, so this is some kind of positivity of this line bundle. And I want to replace that positivity by some kind of sufficiently non-negative. So it turns out that the appropriate notion to use is sort of an algebraic geometric notion, this notion of big and nef. So if you're ample, you're big and nef, but not necessarily vice versa. So a holomorphic line bundle being nef will just say this pairing. So if I take C1 of my line bundle on any holomorphic curve, this should be non-negative. If it was ample, this number will be positive. And then big, well again, if it was ample, then we know that when I take a high tensor power of L, it will have lots of holomorphic sections. So big just says that I still want that. I want the number of holomorphic sections to grow with the tensor power as fast as possible. This is what big and nef means. So for positive, for ample line bundles, then probably everyone knows the Kadira vanishing and the refinements due to Nakano, et cetera. If we have this slightly weaker condition of big and nef, then there's a partial substitute for that, the Kalamata-Vivek vanishing. So using this, then a number of basic facts about Fano manifolds turn out also to hold for weak Fano manifolds. So the most important of these is, so in around 1980, then a fundamental result of Shakurov showed that on any smooth Fano threefold, then if I take a sufficiently generic anti-canonical divisor, then that is a smooth K3. So Shakurov's result is why Kovalev could start with a Fano threefold. But it really, you can run the same argument replacing Kadira vanishing everywhere with Kalamata-Vivek vanishing, and Miles Reed noticed this. So if you do the same thing with weak Fano threefolds, these also have anti-canonical divisors that are smooth K3s generically. So the basic setup works. If you just want to construct your asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yau, it works just as well in the weak Fano case as it did in the Fano case. So, but I said that was only part of the story because you also needed to achieve this matching. So first of all, you know, what's the benefit of moving from weak Fano, from Fano to weak Fano? So the first thing is that there are many more weak Fanos than Fanos. So Fano threefolds have been completely classified sort of using the minimal model program. So you have 105 deformation families. There are thousands of weak Fano threefolds, and it's known that there are only finitely many types, but the precise number is still unknown. But there's certainly many thousands of these. So generalizing from Fano to weak Fano immediately gives you many, many more asymptotically cylindrical Calabi-Yau threefolds that you can try and use in the twisted connect sum. But I mean, the original reason why we were interested in this was the following important fact, was that, well, the anti-canonical bundle is ample in a Fano. So if I start off with a holomorphic curve in a Fano, then it must intersect any anti-canonical divisor. But the anti-canonical divisor is essentially our infinity. So it says any holomorphic curve goes off to infinity. So on the other hand, if we could find a curve that stayed away from infinity that was, say, rigid, then I could take S1 across that. That would give me a rigid associative in my sort of degenerate example, and then in the gluing, then I would be able to perturb this to an exact rigid associative. So because the anti-canonical bundle is no longer ample but only big and nef, then there are some very special curves that don't hit anti-canonical divisors. And they're often they are rigid P1s. And so then what I can do is anytime I find a rigid P1 in my weak Fano threefold, then I'm going to get a rigid associative. So it's really crucial from this to go from Fano to weak Fano. But as I said, it doesn't quite work for we need a bit more than just weak Fano for things to work because we need to arrange this matching. So we need to construct one of these hyperkala rotations between a pair of K3s that are sitting inside of a pair of weak Fano. Or I can only give a kind of sketch of what sort of is necessary, but essentially you need to look at the deformation theory of this pair. And there needs to be a sufficiently good deformation theory in order for these ideas about how to solve matching via global Torelli and lattice embedding theorems can work. And some parts of the deformation theory work with weak Fano, but some of them require slightly more cohomology vanishing theorems than you have for a general weak Fano. So there's some intermediate notion of something that's a weak Fano but a little bit stronger. And it's said in terms of its anti-canonical model. So because of this condition of big and nef, some general theorems in algebraic geometry say that it has a nice anti-canonical model. So there's some kind of associated variety. It's also three-dimensional, but in general will be somewhat singular. And that will be a sort of singular Fano associated to the weak Fano. And it contracts some things between the weak Fano and its anti-canonical model. And then what we require is that it can't contract too much. So one version is saying this contraction is small, which means at most curves get contracted to points. But we can also allow things to be so-called semi-small, which allows a divisor to get contracted to a curve, but not a divisor to get contracted to a point. So those are what we call semi-Fano, which is not the same as Conan's use of semi-Fano, unfortunately. So it turns out that under this sort of extra technical assumption, then the argument for constructing hyperkala rotation still works. So the basic upshot is anytime I find myself a semi-Fano threefold, then I'm good to go to construct G2 manifolds. So as a result of this, then we can show that there are lots of topological types of G2 manifolds that will contain rigid associative curves. And the way that we're constructing them is by taking these rigid P1s, so they have topology S1 cross S2. So I've sort of sketched why already. So why do we get these things rigid? So we take our compact holomorphic curve that doesn't go off to infinity. So we've got some C here. We take S1 cross C inside of S1 cross M1. We now do this gluing. The gluing just changes things mainly out here. It will have a very small effect here. This thing we choose to be rigid as a holomorphic curve, so this makes this thing rigid as an associative, so this thing will survive then a small perturbation. So that this just says the same sort of thing. So I should say, you know, why are the deformations of associatives more complicated? Essentially, this is because the infinitesimal deformations are some kind of twisted harmonic spinners. So we get a self-adjoint problem with index zero, So it's hard to control the kernel or co-kernel separately. You can't control them separately. So it means the deformation theory certainly can be obstructed, and it's difficult to compute in general. Precisely because this thing looks like the product with a holomorphic curve and the holomorphic deformations you can understand, this is what is enough to give you control here. So let me just finish with one example, at least, of something that's a weak Fano that's not Fano. And many more can be constructed the same kind of way. So basically, so if I took a quartic in P4, that's a generic quartic in P4 will be a smooth Fano threefold. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow it to degenerate, to pick up some singularities, and then resolve those singularities in a particular way. So if I look at a quartic and I impose the condition that it contains a special kind of surface, namely just a projective plane. So if I think of my projective plane in homogeneous coordinates as x0 and x1 vanishing, so I think of my quartic now as being x0 times some cubic plus x1 times some cubic. I look at what happens when I intersect with the plane. So then the restriction of these two things now gives me two plane cubics. But the plane cubics are going to intersect in 9 points generically. And those 9 points will be 9 singular points of my quartic. And they will be the simplest kinds of singular points, these so-called ordinary double points. But because this thing has this plane sitting inside of it that contains all of the singular points, then I can just blow up that plane. And that will give me a smooth, projective, small resolution of this singular quartic. And each of these 9 nodes will now become a rigid P1. And the normal bundle will be O minus 1, O minus 1. So this thing really is infinitesimally rigid. And so then this is exactly the kind of thing that I can use. And something built out of this will give rise to 9 associative submanifolds coming from these 9 rigid curves. Let me stop.
Are there any questions or comments?
Hi, Mark. If you have a rational curve hitting the K3 in both sides, can you use that to group an S3, associative S3?
So with Johannes, then we have been thinking about other ways to get associative S3s, but they go back more to look at the curve in your original Fano that will hit now.
Hit the K3, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that may be the section of the vibration.
Yeah, so we were not looking at the ones that were sections of the vibration. But so then you get some matching problem for a pair of curves. And so we, in some particular cases, then we can show that you can make this matching happen. But we don't have a sort of systematic general theory that sort of helps us understand in what set of Fanos can I, again, I'm going to have to usually deform the Fano and deform the anticanonical divisor in order to allow these pair of holomorphic curves to actually meet in the right way. So the answer is yes, there are some associative S3s that arise this way, but it's much less systematic than what we can do this way. So
if the K3 has elliptic vibration, you're...
So we were not looking at the case where we hadn't looked at the case where the K3 itself had an elliptic vibration, but there's no reason you couldn't be looking at something like that.
So you get co-associative vibration in this example?
Well, you know, the geometry is essentially the same as the geometry in Kovalev's example. So, you know, you away from the singular fibers, you would be fine. But trying to prove that you can actually get a co-associative vibration that extends over the whole thing runs into the same problems as he already had. So we've stayed away from that problem, thinking that that's Alexei's. Say?
Near the grid, the vibration, the co-associative vibration is okay, right? It's only near the singular fiber.
Yes, yes. I mean, because these things start off as holomorphic. They're all holomorphic in the original manifold. So, yeah. So you certainly have some topological K3 vibration with singular fibers, but whether you can really make it co-associative.
Any more questions, comments?
Can you just give us some rough idea how diverse the topological type manifolds? And also, you mentioned some different on the same smooth manifold, you get different.
Yeah. So the main reason that it's easier for us to understand the topology of our examples than Dominic's examples is that in the orbifold construction, there was only one of Dominic's examples where the second Betti number was zero. On the other hand, with these twisted connect sums, if you sort of twist, I mean, given two building blocks, then in general, it's actually possible to find different matching data that gives a G2 manifold. If I do something sort of generic enough, then it turns out that even if the original building blocks have some B2, then that will get killed when I match them together. So it's possible to find things that are simply connected and actually two connected. So now the classification of two connected seven manifolds is actually sort of relatively classical. And there isn't so much that you need to know. At least if you want to know them up to almost diffeomorphism. So for a seven manifold, then I could take a connect sum with a homotopy seven sphere, and these things are almost diffeomorphic. I mean, they don't change the homotopy type. And so up to almost diffeomorphism, the classification is relatively straightforward. I just need to know the rank of H3. Then possibly there's some torsion in H4. And if there's some torsion in H4, then there's some algebraic linking form. Then I also need to know what the first Pontryagin class is. So basically, if I know the simplest cases will have no torsion, and then all I need to know is what's the rank of B3 and what's the first Pontryagin number. So then it turns out you can understand what the first Pontryagin number is essentially by understanding what the second Chern class of the two building blocks is. So then this in good cases, then you can show that in fact it didn't matter if you connect some with a homotopy sphere, you're not changing the diffeomorphism type. So basically it reduces to, you need to completely understand the integral cohomology of your building blocks and C2 of the building blocks, and then how P1 is built out of those two things. So after you've done that, then now you just can compute in some systematic way, and as long as these invariants agree, these things will be diffeomorphic. So in fact, you can find lots and lots of a priori completely different G2 things that you can show are actually diffeomorphic. So I do have some specific examples, but it would take some further time to explain where they come from.
Any more questions? All right, so